From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. The Senate has adjourned until Monday as Republicans and Democrats remain at odds over the next pandemic relief bill. There is urgency because extra unemployment benefits end today. Florida Senator Rick Scott, a Republican, joins us now. Senator, welcome back.
Nice to be back with you, Jeremy.
Well, let me ask you about the relief bill, because the extra $600 in unemployment benefits expires today. That's millions of Americans who soon won't be able to pay rent or buy things that they need. These are payments that also help to prop up the rest of the economy, and they're about to go away. Why has the Senate adjourned for the week without finding a solution to this?
Jeremy, they shouldn't. You know, if you stop and think about what we ought to be doing is focus on the people that are hurting. I was disappointed yesterday. We had two opportunities to work on the unemployment, and Chuck Schumer came down, blocked that. You know, one thing about being in Congress, you have to figure out how to work well with others. And right now, this place does not work. And we've been, Jeremy, we have been so inefficient with the dollars that we've spent. The new proposal, one side wants $3 trillion, the other side starting at $1 trillion. Somebody's going to pay for this.
So you seem to be saying that you don't want to spend that kind of money, even in the midst of an unprecedented pandemic and economic disaster. You don't think we should be spending trillions more?
What we ought to do is we ought to spend the dollars it takes to do the things that we care about, like make sure we get a vaccine, make sure we get, you know, the testing, and, you know, we're behind in testing again. Make sure that we help the unemployed. Make sure that we help our small businesses stay in business and reopen. Should we be spending money for the National Endowment for the Arts? Should we be spending money for a new FBI building or the Kennedy Center? No, we shouldn't be spending money like that. We're borrowing an unprecedented amount of money, and we're never going to be able to pay for this if we don't get this economy reopened again.
Well, what about aid for states and cities that are facing massive budget holes? Democrats want to give $1 trillion to that to prevent massive layoffs. The GOP proposal contains no additional funding for state and local governments. You're a former governor. Don't you think that's a mistake to not give them any money right now when they need it?
So, Jeremy, I don't believe we ought to be bailing out prior bad budgets. Like, I don't believe we should use the coronavirus as a reason to pay for Illinois or California's or New Jersey's pension plans that are unfunded. First off, we paid for already. We gave the states over $500 billion and access to another $500 billion in loans. And what I've asked is the states, tell us how you've used that money so we can figure out what we should be doing. Less than 10 governors responded. They just want us to hand them a blank check that they can do anything with.
So you sound very far apart from Democrats, obviously, on this. Do you think then it's possible that there will be no bill at all, no agreement on a bill to help people out who are unemployed right now, who are struggling even to put food on the table?
That would be a mistake if nothing happens. Look, I'm optimistic. We'll be back on Monday, and I hope that this weekend everybody will come back with a renewed focus to say, let's focus on the virus, focus on the unemployed, focus on reopening our economy.
So you don't include in that list their liability protections, which is something that Senate Republicans have been pushing for. The White House, apparently, according to The Washington Post, is willing to cut a deal that does not include liability protections for businesses. Would you support a bill without liability protections?
Jeremy, I think that would be a mistake. I think it'll hurt reopening our economy. We've got to make sure that we don't, you know, put our businesses, our schools, our hospitals in a position that they can't provide the services they provide because they're worried about getting sued. It has to be in there.
Let me just ask you about COVID-19, especially in your state. Florida has seen an enormous spike in cases. You're now seeing daily records of people dying from COVID-19. Why do you think this happened in Florida after so many months of warnings in the form of experiences of other states like New York and New Jersey?
I think at every level of government, the government has not done a great job of getting information out. They should have been very consistent about masks, about social distancing all along, about what you ought to be doing, giving us more information about where the transmission is. If that restaurant has had coronavirus, you should tell me. We should be.
Well, so on the issue of messaging, then, the president retweeted a video the other day of a doctor urging people not to wear masks. And the doctor also said there's a cure for COVID, which there isn't. So isn't the president really responsible for this inconsistent messaging on coronavirus?
Jeremy, I didn't see that, but I can just tell you that If people are not convinced they should wear a mask, then everybody involved, and you can talk about the media too, everybody involved, they got up their message. There should be more information out here for people to make informed decisions, because you know what? People are smart.
I just want to ask you one last thing, Senator. President Trump said he was rescinding a policy that requires cities to track and fix barriers to fair housing. Now, you grew up in public housing. He tweeted, "I'm happy to inform all of the people living their suburban lifestyle dream that you will no longer be bothered or financially hurt by having low-income housing built in your neighborhood." What's your response to that?
You know, Jeremy, I grew up in public housing. I've been blessed. I didn't see the details. So I'll look into it. I know in Carson, Secretary Carson, he's trying to give more flexibility to states on how to handle affordable housing, but I believe we've got to make sure people can have a place to live and they can afford to live there. And, you know, in the term, I think that especially what we're going through right now, you got to step up your game to make sure that we help everybody.
So that's not offensive to you, what the president tweeted?
Jeremy, I didn't see the details. I'll clearly try to understand what they're doing. And, you know, I want to make sure people have affordable housing. It helped my family when I was a kid, so it's important to me.
That is Florida Senator Rick Scott, a Republican. Thank you so much, Senator, for joining us.
All right, thanks, Jeremy. Have a good day. Stay safe.
And you as well.
Let's bring in now NPR White House reporter Ayesha Roscoe. And Ayesha, earlier today, Speaker Nancy Pelosi said that these delays from Republicans in coming up with a relief bill has caused deaths, and that the political fallout for President Trump could be great. What have you been hearing if no deal happens soon in extending unemployment benefits?
Right now, the White House is saying that negotiations will be ongoing. White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows was at a news briefing, and he said that there were four proposals that the White House put forward on extending unemployment benefits and eviction protection. And he said that the Democrats rejected those and that they didn't offer a counteroffer. I'm sure Democrats will have something to say about that. But that's what the White House is saying right now. The issue is for the president is that you're going to have people who are going to really be suffering when these unemployment benefits run out. And right now, there is no solution for that. And so you're going to have people hurting as we go into the fall. You know, there's a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah, a lot of uncertainty. I want to ask you about some other political news. So after pushback from Republicans, President Trump backtracked slightly from his tweet yesterday, suggesting a delay in the November election because he claims there will be mail fraud involving ballots. Let's listen.
I don't want a delay. I want to have the election. But I also don't want to have to wait for 3 months and then find out that the ballots are all missing and the election doesn't mean anything.
What is the president trying to do here? And will he likely succeed in this?
I think there's a lot going on. First, we have to say that the president cannot delay the election. It is not in his power to do so. It is up to Congress, and members of Congress, Republicans and Democrats, all said absolutely not. So it is not in his power to do that. But it also seemed like the president was, you know, trying to focus the attention of the media and the public yesterday on something that he wanted to talk about. You had really bad GDP numbers come out yesterday with a historic decline in the U.S. GDP this year. And so it seemed like instead of talking about that, he's tweeting this kind of drops this big, you know, oh, look at this. I'm going to try to maybe we should delay the election. And then by the end of the day, he said.
And it looks like we might have lost Ayesha Roscoe. We will try to get her back shortly. Oh, you're back.
I'm back.
I lost you for a second. With the few moments that I have with you, I want to ask you, though, Trump's top coronavirus advisors told Congress this morning that, of course, it's unclear how long this pandemic will last. Is the White House coming up with new plans beyond the president's belated effort to promote social distancing and mask wearing?
It doesn't seem like it. President Trump was asked yesterday about whether he was going to be unveiling a new strategy. And he said, you're looking at it. They do have this strategy where it comes to that they call their Ember strategy, where they're going to try to send out public health officials to places where there may be issues with cases rising to try to get the message out, as you said, about wearing masks and social distancing. But right now, it doesn't seem like there is any concerted effort for a real national plan for handling the coronavirus.
That's NPR's Aisha Roscoe, White House reporter. As always, thank you so much.
Thank you.
In a few weeks, teachers across the nation will embark on a new school year, full of uncertainty and unlike anyone they've ever experienced. A recent USA Today Ipsos poll shows that about 20% of teachers surveyed said they have not decided to return. They have decided not to return to the classroom if they're required to teach in person. Other educators are making contingency plans to protect themselves and having tough conversations about their own mortality in the face of in-person teaching. One of those teachers is Denise Bradford, who's been teaching kindergarten for 30 years, and she joins us now. Welcome, Denise.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you've begun writing a living will as you think forward to what the school year might bring. This is a really heavy task in the face of all of the uncertainty right now. Tell us more.
So firstly, I just want to say that there's no one more eager to get back to school than teachers like me. We miss our students. We miss the aha moments. However, there is just simply so much on the minds of teachers like me. One of the things on the list of tasks to do going back to school is to figure out a plan of what we will do and how we will help students and other colleagues should a student or a teacher die. I don't think I'm alone in trying to be prepared. No one wants to leave their family with a big mess.
Sure. You teach in Orange County, California. And to remind our listeners, the Board of Education there voted to return children to schools without face masks or social distancing, despite a surge in coronavirus cases. I mean, we should say that of the districts within the county, many have decided against the recommendations and will hold classes virtually. But even the prospect of going back puts you specifically in a vulnerable position. You mentioned your family.
Definitely, it puts us in a vulnerable position. Unfortunately, we weren't very surprised by the Orange County Board's recommendation. And as far as my family, my mom is 79. And if I go to school, that really puts my entire family at risk when I come back home. I have a daughter with asthma. Does that mean I don't get to see my daughter for the school year?
Right, because then you'd have to make contingency plans for coming home every day to lessen your family's risk of exposure if you've been exposed. You know,
exactly.
This is typically the time when teachers are in full preparation mode. We're talking just a few weeks until school is supposed to start. How is this summer been for you?
It would certainly be more fun to be focusing on writing lesson plans than planning for what if we die. But I will say that our district, and I know many other districts, have been actually having professional development for teachers all summer. Teachers have been preparing because we knew there was a good chance this might happen. That we would go back to distance learning. And so everybody's been pretty much working to be prepared so that we have a much better plan. I think it's going to be a very different experience in the fall. But I can tell you it has not been a relaxing summer for any teacher that I know.
Absolutely. For any of us, but absolutely for teachers who are always planning forward. 30 years, you obviously love what you do. What additional considerations do you want school districts to take on as they develop plans for the upcoming school year?
I think at the local level, most school districts, as including mine, are following the health department guidelines for state and locals. I think that one of the bigger issues is that school districts don't have the resources to really maintain even the most basic preventative measures. it's unfortunate that this has become a very political issue, but safe school reopening and equity for our communities requires funding. Unless the federal government steps in to help the states with school funding, it's going to be really hard to go back safely.
That's Denise Bradford. She's a longtime elementary school teacher from the Saddleback Valley Unified School District in Orange County, California. Denise, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Tanya.
Well, earlier this week, the American Federation of Teachers, the second largest teachers union, authorized its local and state chapters to strike if districts don't make sufficient precautions to keep teachers and students safe. President Randy Weingarten joins us now on Skype with the latest on those recommendations. Welcome back to Here and Now.
It's always wonderful to be with NPR. Thank you.
So, Randy, you've said striking is definitely a last resort, but it is a powerful tool. And one of the main pushes from the union is for districts to wait until COVID-19 transmission rates in a community fall below 1% and average daily positive rates stay below 5%. There are very few places that have achieved these numbers. What else are you advising?
Well, when we look at the 5% number, it means that community spread is below 5%. That was the number that Governor Cuomo, Governor Newsom Governor Cuomo in New York and Governor Newsom in California to make decisions about school opening and school closing. And so that's why this threshold becomes very important as an absolute line in the sand. And then after that, making sure that there is testing and tracing and the guardrails that you have to have in schools to prevent transmission. And the fact that there's a debate over this and that President Trump, who, you know, threw money at the cruise ship industry, his son-in-law took money from the PPP program. Why there would be debate over these kind of baseline standards that are necessary to contemplate schooling, as important as schooling is.
So I want to ask you more about this. So, I mean, this is not a cheap endeavor. You're asking for the federal government to help pay for these support systems, and we're talking billions of dollars. I mean, Congress is having a hard time coming up with a relief bill that they can all agree upon. Schools in some parts of the country will open in just a few weeks. We're talking 2 weeks. What's realistic at this point?
Well, that is a really good question. If you knew the money was coming for personal protective equipment, then of course districts could buy these things. But if you don't know it's coming, how do you open schools and say to people, oh, yes, we know Dr. Fauci and everybody else is saying that masks are really important, but sorry, we don't have them. I mean, it's just ludicrous. Just to fully reopen in places where there's no virus surge, you need $500 billion to $600 billion. So they can't talk out of both sides of their mouth and say, we need to do this, but then not give us the resources to get it done.
I want to ask you about something else. So we know that Black and Latino people in this country are suffering disproportionately from the pandemic. And this is an intersectional problem because many live in poor communities that rely heavily on schools for services. What are you advising those districts to do as they weigh not only how to open, but how to serve their communities?
Three things. Number one, World Central Kitchen, Jose Andreas, and the AFT teamed up, and now many of the not-for-profit food groups and the NAACP, and we are envision opening school kitchens to actually serve communities. And so we've all teamed up to try to do that and to get the resources from Congress for that. Number two, we need to make sure that connectivity is real. And we should get digital equipment to every kid who needs it. Number three, we are trying to make sure that even if we are in remote, our instruction is more contoured to remote. We have this platform called Share My Lesson that we've made free to parents, to kids, to educators, whether they're in our union or not. And we put tips on what to do about remote instruction every single day on it.
You know, I mean, the fallout from this pandemic, no one can mitigate. I mean, we're all just trying to do the best we can. Are you concerned about the educational disparity gap widening? I mean, is there a way to mitigate it? You've laid out these three plans, and they sound like really solid plans. But the truth is that many wealthier communities will have the resources to educate their children during this time. And many of those communities that we're just talking about are really at a disadvantage, and lay out for us some of the systemic problems that we've been dealing with for decades in this moment.
I'm really concerned, and it's part of why, frankly, we need a new president. And frankly, it is now up to the teachers to actually rectify all of the mistakes that the Trump administration has done in fighting this virus, which is part of the reason why we started in April trying to figure out how to reopen schools and knew that these three things, where community spread is, having the safety guardrails, including that which you need to do in school, as well as testing, and being able to have the resources to pay for it. And that's why we have said very reluctantly that if we can't get these things any other way, we will authorize safety strikes as a last resort.
Randy Weingarten is the president of the American Federation of Teachers, the second largest teachers union in the country. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
At a time when monuments that glorify the Confederacy are coming down across this country, some are asking what should go up in their place. Well, for four decades, a Georgia-based sculptor has been creating public artwork that commemorates what he calls a more complete history of our communities and our country. Emil Moffitt from member station WABE in Atlanta has this profile.
In his home workshop in Stone Mountain, Georgia, Iwakunle Odeleye's larger-than-life pieces of public art often start off as small wooden mock-ups that he shapes with a lathe.
But I can get in here, screw a piece of wood to a plate, and this thing will turn, and I can cut all kinds of shapes and forms.
The finished monument can wind up soaring into the air, like the bronze monument called Spirit Family Community that went up in Atlanta before the 1996 Olympics. Odeleye is tall and lean, with a gray goatee. He's 68 years old and has more time for his projects now that he's retired after nearly 30 years teaching art and sculpture at Kennesaw State University. Teaching is what brought him to Atlanta in the early 1980s. He chose that profession because he wanted to do for his students what his high school and college instructors did for him.
To give them ideas, to work with them, to watch them grow, to watch them learn, is an exciting thing. It's kind of like throwing seeds in the dirt. Over time, you watch those seeds take root, and beautiful kinds of things occur.
In addition to teaching, Odeleye has spent his career specializing in public artwork in the form of sculptures. He's done dozens of projects around the country. His latest commission is a 30-foot tall by 27-foot wide steel gateway monument he's creating in southwest Atlanta. It's a sculpture that'll feature the likeness of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., imagery paying tribute to the African-American heritage of many of the city's residents, and an homage to Atlanta's educational and religious institutions and music scene. Capturing the history of a place in a piece of public art is Odeleye's specialty.
So I've done slave memorials, I've done pieces that honor particular individuals, I've done pieces where the cities want to talk about the history of the city, both the struggles, the evolution, the growth, the diversity of communities.
One of those cities is Wilmington, North Carolina, where Odeleye created a monument made up of six bronze boat paddles, each reaching 16 feet into the air. It memorializes a race riot in 1898 in which a white mob overthrew the city government and terrorized the African-American community. In addition to his work around the country, he's done smaller pieces of artwork in Atlanta. For example, Odeleye crafted the lectern at Ebenezer Baptist Church. And in the southwest part of Atlanta, in the Cascade Road neighborhood, you'll find a steel sundial surrounded by 12 hour markers, each adorned with the name of someone from the community who's made an impact on the world.
They wanted a work that really highlighted education, learning, That's a middle-class community. Education is very important in there. And so when I listened to the committee talk about those things, I came up with the concept of enlightenment.
And it's this kind of community involvement, Odelay says, that's an integral part of his artistic process. And it's what makes public art meaningful to the people who see it most. For Here and Now, I'm Emil Moffitt in Atlanta.
The NBA is back.
Here's Kuzma with a shot clock at 7, cross-court 3, Davis, caught!
Last night, the NBA rebooted its season after a 5-month pandemic pause. That sound was from the Lakers-Clippers game. The Lakers won 103-101. The other season opener was between Utah Jazz and the New Orleans Pelicans. The Jazz won 106-104. Both games were housed inside of the league's more than $150 million bubble at Walt Disney World in Orlando, Florida. And that's where we find Tim Bontemps, NBA writer for ESPN. Tim, you're actually bubble adjacent, but what is it like down there?
It's a pretty strange situation, Jeremy. As somebody who's paid to go to basketball games for a job, it was definitely a surreal experience to be at the games last night and to go and cover, you know, a truly, hopefully, once-in-a-lifetime event. You know, there's all kinds of barriers around where you're supposed to go or not go, and I'm bubble adjacent, so I'm in the yellow tier, it's called. So there's all these signs where yellow tier people go this way, green people tier go this way, and, you know, there's all kinds of glass walls up, and everyone's wearing masks, and everyone, it's just surreal, I guess, is how I would describe it. Because the basketball was normal watching the games, but everything around the games was as far from normal as it could be.
Well, yeah, I watched some of one of the games last night, and if you were careful about how closely you looked, it almost looked like, and certainly sounded like, there were actually fans there. They did a pretty good job.
Yeah, it was weird being in the arena, hearing those noises, like the fan noises. To me, it almost sounded like white noise. It was kind of a jarring thing in person. But look, this is essentially the NBA on a soundstage being broadcast out to the world, right? There's obviously no fans at the games. There's a couple hundred personnel in there, whether it's, you know, media like me or lead personnel trying to work the games and refs and camera people and whatever. But the vast majority of people are going to be like you who are at home watching it. So this entire operation is really geared toward trying to make this seem like as normal of a viewing experience as you could possibly have, as well as making it as normal an experience for the players on the court as it possibly can be. And I think from that standpoint, both those standpoints, I should say, I think the NBA did a pretty good job of pulling this thing off so far.
Well, and they also want to make it as normal as they can when it comes to advertising. There was specific advertising on the actual court. Are they going to do that for every game?
I think so. It's funny. One of my colleagues was texting me during the game saying, is this on the court? Is this on the court? And I just kept saying, nope, it's not. Huh. It's not there. That's just an illusion on the TV. And I suspect that's going to happen quite a bit. On some of the local broadcasts I saw before I came down here, they had some of the team logos and stuff on the court. Obviously, that happened last night on TNT. But yeah, no, it's funny for me being there and looking at the court and just seeing what it is. Like, that's one experience. And then for everybody else at home, I think it's pretty clear that it's going to be a very different experience for people watching from their couch.
I also want to ask you about the messaging on the back of jerseys that players were wearing in place of their names. It was Black Lives Matter, Say Her Name. Players also knelt and locked arms before both games. How is this act of protest being received?
I think it's being received well. Everybody obviously was aware that this was going to be a dominant theme of this restart. Over the past couple months, NBA players have been incredibly vocal in the wake of George Floyd's death in Minneapolis. And like, I had a sense of what the players were going to do and the coaches were going to do, but to see everyone kneel like that before the game and just the utter silence that was in the arena other than the music playing, it was a pretty powerful moment. And I thought, you know, for a group of players that wanted to come down here and, you know, take part in this thing and try to get their message out to the world and, you know, kind of speak to what they think is important and what they want to see changed, I thought it was a really powerful way for them to start off what should be, you know, a couple months of hopefully competitive, good basketball and, you know, a lot of focus on the way that a lot of things in our society are today.
Let me just finally ask you, this so far seems to be working. I mean, it was only one night so far, but are they worried in the NBA that they're going to end up in the situation like Major League Baseball, which is now dealing with outbreaks?
Well, listen, Jeremy, this is the whole key to this entire thing, right? Can the NBA keep the virus out? I was personally most concerned about the first couple of weeks right when the bubble was formed. We saw with MLS, which is also down here in Orlando, in the immediate aftermath of them getting everyone inside the bubble, they had a couple teams. It was Nashville and Dallas. They both had a bunch of positive tests, and they had to pull out of the whole thing entirely. And the NBA is not going to be able to withstand having to lose a team from this thing. But so far, there's been no positive tests inside the bubble. We're now more than 3 weeks in. And I would say the NBA is cautiously optimistic. There was certainly nobody at the games last night. Adam Silver was there. Some owners were there. Nobody was there doing handstands and saying, we've solved this thing. It's going to be fine.
Mm-hmm.
I think everybody is kind of just holding their breath and probably will be for the next 10 weeks or so, hoping that they can get from now to the end without any kind of outbreak, like you mentioned, because that could obviously bring this whole thing crashing down to the ground in a hurry.
That is Tim Bontemps, NBA writer for ESPN, joining us from adjacent to the NBA bubble in Orlando, Florida. Tim, thank you so much.
My pleasure, Jeremy. Thanks for having me.
And as I just said, Major League Baseball is having some trouble. More players have tested positive for COVID-19, and the league announced tonight's Brewers-Cardinals game is postponed. The pandemic could end the 60-game season and playoffs, costing MLB billions in lost broadcast revenues. Let's bring in Here and Now media analyst John Carroll. John, how much money has the MLB already lost because of the pandemic?
Well, Forbes.com reported that the owners estimated a loss of $4 billion if the season consisted of only 81 games, which is half a regular season. That might have been gamesmanship in their negotiations with the players' union, but certainly playing in empty ballparks means you don't only lose ticket revenues, but there are no concession sales, there's no parking revenue, there are no souvenir sales. So this has been a major hit for them.
And now they're looking only at a 60-game season, although they have expanded playoffs. And then we see, of course, the news today that even more games are being canceled because of COVID outbreaks. What does this mean for advertising on the games, which I imagine brings in a huge amount of money in normal times for Major League Baseball?
It does. There seems to be a fair amount of pent-up demand. Fox Broadcast Network says it sold out 90% of its inventory for the games. Regional sports networks seem to be selling ads pretty well. There are potentially 22 extra postseason games, and advertisers pay a premium for them. So by one estimate, there could be as much as $587 million in national ads if the season actually goes through.
And it's one thing, of course, to have the ability to advertise. It's another thing to try to find the right ad for this moment in time. And some of the national brands are rolling out ads that reflect the current state of baseball. Here's a Bud Light ad featuring a beer vendor walking down a suburban street, hawking his wares.
Get your ice cold Bud Light, Bud Light. Sell to hip. Even though you can't go to the game, doesn't mean the game can't be brought to you now, hip. Just go to BudLight.com/delivery.
Yeah,
clever. There are a lot of, yeah, it is. And there are a lot of ads that are tailored. There are also promotions like Bank of America has this Let's Rally campaign where if a team comes back from two runs down after the seventh inning and wins, they donate $10,000 to the Boys and Girls Club of America. So there's a lot of specific advertising to the state of baseball right now.
And teams are also expanding their ad offerings on the fields. Tell us more about that.
Yeah, so basically teams can sell real or virtual ads all over the field. They can sell them on the back of the pitcher's mound. They can sell them down the first baseline, the third baseline, in the on-deck circle. I mean, there's real potential that games could look like a NASCAR race.
What about those cardboard cutouts in the stands at some ballparks, John?
Yeah, over a dozen teams have basically set up a program where you can pay to have your likeness on a cardboard cutout in the stands for home games. And the prices range from $25 to $299, depending on the team and the location of the seats.
You know, John, we're talking about this as if it's like a great idea that they're figuring out how to deal with the ads. But the fact is, none of this is going to work if they have to cancel games because of a COVID outbreak, which appears to be happening because they're not in a bubble like the NBA.
Right. Major League Baseball says there's no way they could have gone into a bubble. But it creates this problem of travel, of all these different ballparks that they're inhabiting. And I think that, you know, this was a challenge from the start. And the Miami Marlins didn't help the situation by going out on the field and playing while their players were infected. So they've set off a kind of a chain reaction that could bring the whole season down.
That is John Carroll, Here Now media analyst. John, thank you.
Thank you.
The situation for millions of unemployed Americans becomes even more dire today. Senate lawmakers have adjourned for the week with no plans to extend the weekly $600 in CARES Act benefits that has been helping families across the country stay afloat during this pandemic. And states are still struggling to respond to a backlog of weeks and sometimes months of jobless claims. Unemployment expert Andrew Stettner with the Century Foundation told us on the show last week that part of the problem is that states are still using outdated systems that prioritize fraud detection.
Those states that have a customer service orientation and think of their job first as paying workers who are unemployed, states like Rhode Island, you know, and increasingly Michigan, you know, they're doing a better job. No state is having it easy.
And Rhode Island is actually among those states embracing technology to better serve unemployed people during the pandemic. Scott Jensen is the director of the Rhode Island Department of Labor and Training, and he joins us now. Scott, welcome.
Nice to be here, Tanya.
So, Scott, Rhode Island is, of course, the smallest state in the U.S., so your situation is a bit different than, say, a place like California. But briefly walk us through the changes you made to your unemployment system during this pandemic, and what have been the results so far?
Well, Rhode Island is a lot smaller than California, but we have the same structure, so we're a very good lab for democracy. So we've been very fortunate to get really, really good and productive partnerships with Amazon Web Services to really help us out. So they bailed the citizens of Rhode Island out with this one, along with my team.
And this Amazon Web Service is a cloud-based system. It gives the department the ability to process up to 2,000 concurrent calls so that folks are not getting a busy signal, essentially.
That's part of it, but we've just started. So in an iterative way, we're going to create a new system on the cloud that will better serve folks trying to get unemployment benefits in this horrible time, but also into the future.
I want to note that other states like Kansas are also using similar technology. I want to ask you about fraud detection. So as we heard earlier, fraud detection isn't necessarily the best priority if you're trying to quickly help people in need. But Rhode Island has paid out more than $8 million in fraudulent unemployment payments during this pandemic. How are you verifying that claims are valid, and how are you planning to beef up those efforts?
So this is a perfect example of what old technology can't do. Old technology that verifies people's existence simply by getting information from them, you know, can't fight what this imposter fraud criminal wave that's hitting every unemployment insurance program in the country. You just can't do it that way. When somebody steals an identity elsewhere and shows up with it, you know, you can't stop it. However, if you think differently about how you're doing it and you create through a much more interactive process, a robust digital fingerprint, that information can be used to combat fraud. And that is, we are building fraud detection into every piece of our new system, which I think is a radically different approach to combating fraud and one that will work. Fraud's always going to be a problem, but you know, we have to think of new ways to combat it.
How concerned are you about Congress changing the $600 CARES Act benefit? It expires today. So really, regardless if it continues in some way or not, it will require your department to change the process of handling claims. How concerning is that?
It's very concerning. You know, I think to begin with, the worst part is there are millions of people in the United States who are waiting with bated breath for something to happen. I am hopeful that Congress will figure out the direction they want the country to take so that those of us tasked with taking that direction can do it. There's an idea floating out there that it's just a simple matter to peg everybody's benefits to some percentage of what they made. We can do that technically. The problem is that data, what exactly someone made, is rather hard to find. And usually it will require, even if we could program it, it requires a lot of adjudication between, you know, our team and people seeking benefits to really get to the bottom of what that number is. So a flat rate is much, much better and can be implemented much more quickly.
You just laid this out to some extent, but what do states need from lawmakers to better serve residents who are unemployed right now?
We needed an answer to what is going to happen with benefits about 2 weeks ago. And the quicker that answer can come, the quicker that, you know, colleagues of mine around the country can gather their teams, spend, you know, every waking moment in order to make the changes necessary to get folks the help that they need. So really, it's a matter of time. We need time.
You need time. Yeah. That is Scott Jensen, the director of the Rhode Island Department of Labor and Training. Scott, thank you so much.
An absolute pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now.